nisamya bhoyatrapi bhagavata rakshanya prayuktam sudarshanam nama bhagavatam daityam astram tattejasa durvishaham muhu parivartamanam abhyavastito muhurtam utvijamanas chakita hrtaya arat eva nivartate tat uparagam iti varanti lokaha. Translation. After hearing from the sun and moon, demigods, about Rahu's attack, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, engages his disc known as the Sudarshan Chakra to protect them. The Sudarshan Chakra is the Lord's most beloved devotee and is favored by the Lord. The intense heat of its effulgence, meant for killing non-Vaishnavas, is unbearable to Rahu, and he therefore flees in fear of it. During the time Rahu disturbs the sun or moon, there occurs what people commonly know as an eclipse. Purport. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, is always the protector of his devotees, who are also known as demigods. The controlling demigods are most obedient to Lord Vishnu, although they also want material sense enjoyment. And that is why they are called demigods, or almost godly. Although Rahu attempts to attack both the sun and the moon, they are protected by Lord Vishnu. Being very afraid of Lord Vishnu's chakra, Rahu cannot stay in front of the sun or moon for more than a muhurta, 48 minutes. The phenomenon that occurs when Rahu blocks the light of the sun or moon is called an eclipse. The attempt of the scientists of this earth to go to the moon is as demoniac as Rahu's attack. Of course, their attempts will be failures because no one can enter the moon or sun so easily. Like the attack of Rahu, such attempts will certainly be failures. Text 4. Tato dastat siddhas charana vijadaranam sadanani tavat matra eva. Translation. Below Rahu by 10,000 yojanas, 80,000 miles, are the planets known as Siddhaloka, Charanaloka, and Vijaraloka. Purport. It is said that the residents of Siddhaloka, being naturally endowed with the powers of yogis, can go from one planet to another by their natural mystic powers without using airplanes or similar machines. Text 5. Tato dastat yaksha raksha pisacha pretabhuta gananam viharajiram antariksham yavat vayu pravati yavan mega upalabhyate. Translation. Beneath Vijaraloka, Charanaloka, and Siddhaloka, in the sky called Antariksha, are the places of enjoyment for the Yakshas, Rakshasas, and Pisachas, ghosts, and so on. Antariksha extends as far as the wind blows, and the clouds float in the sky. Above this, there is no more air. Text 6. Tato dastachata yojanantara iyam prithivi yavadamsha Vasha Shena Suparnadaya Patatri Pravara Utpatantiti. Translation. Below the abodes of the Yakshas and Rakshasas, by a distance of 100 yojanas, 800 miles, is the planet Earth. Its upper limits extend as high as swans, hawks, eagles, and similar large birds can fly. Text 7. Upavarnitam bhumer yatha sanivesha vastanam avaner apyatastat sapta bhu vivara ekai kasho yojanayu tantare na yama vistare na paklipata atalam vitalam sutalam talatalam mahatalam rasatalam patalam iti. Translation. My dear king, beneath this earth are seven other planets known as Atala, Vitala, Sutala, Talatala, Mahatala, Rasatala, and Patala. I have already explained the situation of the planetary systems of Earth. The width and length of the seven lower planetary systems are calculated to be exactly the same as those of Earth. 6-8, almost there. Iteshu hi bilash svargeshu, svargat apyadikar, Kama Bhogaishwaryananda Bhuti Vibhuti Bihi Sushamrita Bhavanodya Nakrita Viha Vihareshu daicha danava katravaya nicha pramudita nurakta kalaprapatya bandhu sur anuchara graha pataya iswarat apya praptiharta kama maya vinoda nivashanti. Translation: in these seven planetary systems, which are also known as the subterranean heavens, Vilasvarga, there are very beautiful houses, gardens, and places of sense enjoyment, which are even more opulent than those in the higher planets, because the demons have a very high standard of sensual pleasure, wealth, and influence. Most of the residents of these planets, who are known as Daityas, Danavas, and Nagas, live as householders. Their wives, children, friends, and society are fully engaged in illusory material happiness. The sense enjoyment of the demigods is sometimes disturbed, but the residents of these planets enjoy life without disturbances. Thus, they are understood to be very attached to illusory happiness. Purport. According to the statement of Prahlad Maharaj, material enjoyment is Maya Sukha, illusory enjoyment. A Vaishnava is full of anxieties for the deliverance of all living entities from such false enjoyment. Prahlad Maharaj says, Maya Sukhaya Bharam Utvahato Vimudan. These fools, Vimudas, are engaged in material happiness, which is surely temporary. Whether in the heavenly planets, the lower planets, or earthly planets, people are engrossed in temporary material happiness, forgetting that in due course of time, they have to change their bodies according to the material laws and suffer the repetition of birth, death, old age, and disease. Not caring what will happen in the next birth, gross materialists are simply busy enjoying during the present short span of life. A Vaishnava is always anxious to give all such bewildered materialists the real happiness of spiritual bliss. Om Jnana Simirandasya Janandana Shilagaya Chakshuram Milcham Vina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasari Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Yes, so Vedic cosmology. We have two types of creation, primary and secondary. This is part of the secondary creation we're describing here. This is the material creation. And we have two ways of looking at it. We can look at it as creation as a verb, as something that goes on, an activity, or a thing that's there, which is what we're looking at here. We're looking at the creation as it is, how it's better. Hare Krishna. How the creation is arranged. Now, I'm from the West, and this is some far out stuff, you know. You got a guy who's a demon, dresses up as a demigod, and drinks some elixir that makes him immortal. His head is cut off, but his head is then immortal and kind of floats out around in space, and that's a planet. And when there's an eclipse, it's him eating the sun, and then it comes out on the other side because he's afraid of God. Okay, you know. And even that's one thing. Another thing is that the Bhagavatam has the audacity to say that our quote-unquote normal way of looking at this is false and illusory. So that is kind of a test, you could say. You know, are we able to actually accept this? In fact, you could say that the whole Bhagavatam is a test. It starts out very first canto with a test. It's like if you want to get anything from this, you have to have the right mood. So it's not giving you anything, it's demanding something from you straight out the bat, you know, straight out. You have to develop the right mood, otherwise forget it. And we see this in many other texts also. The Acharyas are saying that basically, if you're not a devotee, just step away from the book, you know, because you won't be qualified. So through the Bhagavatam, we see these tests coming up, because it is a reformatory product. It's a reformatory thing. It's for our benefit. Now, it's for our benefit in the sense that we're getting what we need, not necessarily what we want. So that's why the mood has to be one of humility. And we know this everywhere. If you go to a modern Western university, you are expected to have some respect for whatever professor is there teaching you something. If you just are critically thinking about everything he says, you're not going to get very far, because you're going to be using all your time being critical rather than actually trying to learn something. And also we can see, I mean, you know, it's said here also that the materialists don't really care for this kind of presentation. We got the sun riding a chariot, you know, and different stuff like that. And a materialist won't really buy it. It's like it's too far out, you know. You have to be crazy to kind of accept this, because it doesn't correspond with anything we are seeing or we are experiencing. But I mean, first of all, we don't mind the word crazy. I mean, we're all crazy; otherwise, we wouldn't be here. So this whole creation is described as being tainted with ignorance, with a faulty idea of our own identity and the purpose for which we are here. So crazy, yeah, we kind of agree actually. What we don't agree with is that there is such a thing as not crazy here, that there is such a thing as objective. It doesn't exist. We can become self-realized, but we can't become fully realized. We can't know everything that's going on. So we have to accept some kind of authority. Now we have to figure out what authority is that. So from the parampara, we can see that these self-realized souls who have fully committed to the Bhagavatam point of view are self-realized. And self-realized means that there is no incoherence between the internal and the external. They are talking the talk, and they're walking the walk, and they're walking the talk. And I mean, we call them the transparent via medium. So in a materialistic consciousness, we would have a goal. We want to attain some goal. We study so that we can get a nice job, get nice houses, as described here. Very high standard of sensual pleasure, wealth and influence, you know. They have nice families and nice houses, gardens, and they're even more opulent than the heavenly planets, because on the heavenly planets, at least there is some element of duty. I mean, and there is some relationship to something else than sense enjoyment. Here, it's just enjoying the senses. So in the material state of mind, you would want a result that is different from where you are. You want to expand. You want to increase your influence, your power, your wealth. But for the transcendentalist, we accept that this is actually technically not possible. Abrahma Bhuvanaloka said that from the topmost planet down to the lowest, it's the same thing. It's the same thing that's going on. It's still, like it said here, birth, death, disease, old age, it's there. And what happens if we obtain larger and larger amounts of sense pleasure or influence, control? We just get used to it and we want more, you know? You see a wealthy person or a poor person, there is no actually, it's not that the wealthy person is happier. He actually often has more worries, more troubles, you know, because who are my real friends, and will I lose all this, or my beautiful wife? Yeah, I think she's beautiful. Everybody else also thinks she's beautiful. So it creates a lot of anxiety. So that's why we say, I mean, high thinking, simple living. The simple living simply means the acceptance that the material things will not make us happy. So we might as well arrange it as simply as possible. So this is difficult, as simply as possible. What does that mean? We hear about renunciation, and I often get questions about, but I can't, you know, I can't renounce, I can't just live on a rock, you know, I can't just live without it. I need something. But that's nice, and this is usually, women are posing this question, but it's not a problem actually, because it's not that you can't have anything. It's just that it's not yours. It's not that you're, I mean, one level you could say you're offering it back to Krishna, but a higher level will be realizing that it's not mine in the first place. I can't even offer it. The offering is just so that I put myself in the consciousness of realizing that it's not mine. That's what the offering is for. Krishna's not doubting. He's not in anxiety, will I get something to eat today? You know, he's got it pretty much under control. It says with the spark of his splendor, all this, I mean, all the universes are going on. It's not a big deal for him. It's a big deal for us because we're not God and we're trying to become God. So then it's a big deal. That's the ultimate attainment of the goal that we want. But for Krishna, that's just standard. You know, that's just, this is how it goes on, you know. And it's just a facility for interaction with the devotees. That's all it is. So if we can adopt that viewpoint on our own lives, that whatever we have is just a facility for reciprocating with Krishna, then everything works out nicely. Because everything material breaks down. It says also here that the spiritualist, he realizes that ultimately these things are temporary. All this enjoyment is temporary. If you get the straight sense enjoyment, as soon as the senses disconnect with the sense object, the experience is over. That's it, it's over. The mind can work a little longer because you can kind of remember what was going on and get a little indirect sense enjoyment from that. But it's still temporary. And even if you're on the level of Dharma, you're doing everything nicely and getting the quote-unquote good karma, it's still temporary because you'll get attached to it and it will go away. I mean, your children will grow up and start their own life regarding of how good a mother or father you are, because that's the way it works. And even if they don't, we're all going to leave this body at some point. It's going to end, you know, so we can't get too attached to the things themselves. So that is why this whole idea of looking at the creation as a thing is not actually usually that conducive to spiritual life, because we get fascinated by it. We get caught up in it. I recently gave a seminar about primary and secondary creation. What interesting was that the devotees generally were much more into the secondary creation. That's Brahma's creation. That's the material creation, because we're in material consciousness. So that's fascinating, with all the planets, and you get nine levels of creation and the Chaturvyuha, who came first and who's who, and that's material consciousness. We're trying to put everything into boxes. What we're actually, the important creation is just the primary, because that's just Krishna sending out, you know, an invite. You could say, come back, you know, that's all it is. And we see in the second canto of Bhagavatam, three first chapters are just about Brahman realization, Paramatma realization, and Bhagavan realization. And the first chapter is called The First Step in God Realization. So what was before, the first canto is just preliminary, just, okay, we have to understand we're not meant to be here. That's basically the purport of that. So then we want to, you know, fully surrender. It's like the Mahabharata in Bhagavatam, you could say. So the creation should be seen as an activity, and we can reverse that to go back to Godhead. So whatever we are attached to, because we are attached, you know, we have the 10th offense says that it's an offense to not have complete faith in the chanting of the holy name and to maintain material attachments, even after understanding so many instructions on this matter. So maintaining, it's not an offense to have material attachments, we all have them, but to maintain them, to cultivate them, to make a philosophy out of them. That's a problem. So if we're too much focused on the externals, then we're not going to make any real progress. But if the externals are just there to develop the proper mood, then that will work, that will be conducive, and we will start our ascent back to Godhead. So like the first chapter, first canto says, you know, you got to develop the mood, and then the rest of the Bhagavatam is generally just how to do that, because it's easy to say, it's a little more difficult to do. So this is the situation that we're in. To distinguish between what is an activity and what is a thing, because things are superfluous. We have these upadis and we have anarthas. You know, we have upadis, our faulty ideas about who we are. I'm a man, I'm a monk, I'm this, I'm that, I'm tall, you know. Or an artist, things that we like to do but we know we shouldn't do, or maybe we don't even know we shouldn't do it, but unwanted desires. So we have to get rid of those, and that's why we need to connect everything back to Krishna, because if we're able to connect everything back to Krishna, then it will be purifying rather than entangling. Because if we think it's for me, that is the materialistic consciousness. There is no materialistic energy, actually. Our idea that there is Krishna, he's in the temple room standing there and looking nice every morning, and then there's something else, you know. Then there's my room with my books, and I have my pens that I use for writing, and I have my cloth, you know, and if someone takes my iPod, I will be very angry. But it's not mine, and I'm gonna give up the iPod anyway, otherwise, you know, I mean, it's not gonna work otherwise. So this idea that there's something that's for me, that is illusion. That's what illusion is. It's just a tool. And even materialists, somewhere back in the mind, they understand this, because why do they want the things? They want the things because they think they will become popular. Because all we're looking for is happiness. It's just a question of how are we looking for it. You know, the materialist wants to be the center of attention because everybody is looking at me. That must mean I'm doing something right and that will make me happy. We see it a little more complete, you know, because we take a step back and see that no, actually, if we are functioning in a larger whole, see, here's the thing that it's nice with Sanskrit, because you can explain philosophical points using grammar. So a materialist would look at himself as the subject, as the center, and then whatever is going on is the object. They are objects. That's why they think they're objective, because everything is objects for their enjoyment, right? But so the neophyte devotee actually sees that it's the other way around. Krishna and his creation is the object, no, the subject, and I'm the object. I'm to be used in Krishna's service. But then the problem comes, what about the other devotees? They're instruments in my service to Krishna, right? That's the third case, subject, object, instrument. The advanced devotee knows that no, actually that's not right. Krishna is the subject, he's the first, then come all the devotees, and then I'm the instrument. I'm the instrument in all the other devotees, is das anudas, in all their service to Krishna. And then it works out, because then there's no false ego left to generate all these anarthas and upadis. So that's how it works out. And will keep working out. If we don't have this mentality, it will be a bumpy ride, because I will like devotees or not like devotees depending on whether or not they get in the way of my service. You know, so if they get away, you know, I'll be, you know, doing Mangalarti, pushing them out the way, because I'm here with Krishna, get out the way, you know. But if I'm looking out for their service, for their reciprocation with Krishna, then everything works out, because Krishna's unlimited, so it's not like he runs out of mercy, right? That's the thing with spiritual value, is that it increases when we share it. Material value decreases. So if I have something and I give it away, I've lost the thing. It's now not mine anymore. But if I have compassion, or if I have attention and I give that to someone, I will get more of it. Because if I'm attentive, others will also want to be attentive towards me. We know this, it's a cliche, but there's reasons that things become cliches. This cliche that smile to the world and the world will smile at you, you know. So in that sense, because it's not dependent on the external energy, it just keeps increasing, it's unlimited. And that's what we're also being told in the scriptures, is that the spiritual energy and the internal potency is always expanding. It always increases. Krishna looks at Radharani and she looks back and he smiles a little, and she notices that and smiles a little more, and then he sees that and smiles a little more, and it just keeps going and building and building. So to the extent that we are able to connect with that as instruments, to that extent we will be connected to the source of happiness, not getting little dribbles of happiness here and there, but actually having it flow through us without anything blocking it. So that's very nice. So how do we do that? We do that by practicing, you know, sadhana, bhakti. Sadhana means practice, because we're not very good at spiritual life, so we need practice. So there are rules and regulations. Basically, simply put, there are one do and four don'ts. Do chant 16 rounds a day and don't eat meat, have illicit sex, gamble, and intoxicate yourself. That's just standard. And if you do that, then you will get purified and everything will function. We say that all you need is the holy name in order to go back to Godhead. And that sounds confusing, because why do we have so big, elaborate books? Because the point is that the holy name will purify us so that we will realize what we need to do. So all the other things come naturally. They kind of come on their own. Finding a guru and, you know, getting up early in the morning. All these things will become second nature, because it is revealed through the chanting. Usually we have, you know, we have different ways of attaining some kind of truth or knowledge. There's the karmic way, you know, you try to rearrange by activity the world so that it is the way that you like it. So then I will be happy. But that's easy to, you know, shoot down, because we're not actually in control. Every time we see that people are failing in this attempt, you know, it doesn't work. We can't arrange everything, because there's everybody else. They have all other ideas about what they like. And so we get into fights and we try to assert our opinion or our influence. And if it doesn't work, we're disappointed. And if it works, then chances are people will be disappointed with us. And then again, it doesn't work. So it doesn't work. Then we have the more intellectual approach of the Gyanis, that actually, you know, it's all one, or it's all, you know, and we can find some intellectual approach to say that this is this and that is that. But it doesn't really function anyway, because our logical faculty is very limited. And we see this, that for everybody else, we can always figure out the solution to their problems. Everybody else's problems are super simple. But our own problems, they're very unique, very complicated, very complex, and it's very deep, and we have to think very hard, and we have to, you know, the fact is, it's not complicated for us either. It's very simple. It's just that our mind is involved. We have attachments. So we have this thing with dilemma. I mean, a dilemma, it's so difficult for me to figure out. Dilemma just means you know what you're supposed to do, but you want to do something else. So that becomes a dilemma, you know. So we're not able to, with our logical faculty, to actually attain real happiness. First of all, because it's limited, and you know, it can't comprehend everything that's going on. And secondly, because we're still attached to what's going on, so it will also be skewed. It will be, you know, misdirected. So actually, only going to the source will enable us to attain this constant happiness. So the source of obviously being Krishna, the cause of all causes. If we're able to connect with Krishna, then everything will work out nicely. And that's why we have all these pages in the books. It's because, you know, you have so many things in your life that you have so many weird ideas about why you have them or what you're going to do with them. The things are not the problem. It's the way that you use them. That's the problem, right? So alcohol, you can use it to clean something, and you can also drink it. So one is good, one is not so good. You know, sex, you can have children and raise them in Krishna consciousness, or you can try to enjoy your body or somebody else's body. One is good, one is not so good. So it's just about how you apply everything, because everything is created. So if it's created, it must have a creator. You know, this atheistic idea that nothing explodes into everything, and then you have Spandau Ballet and mayonnaise and cars. It doesn't really work, because if we see everything that we've experienced in our life, it comes from somewhere. A tree comes from a seed, a car comes from a factory, you know, I mean, cloth comes from the wala. So everything must come from something. It can't come from nothing. That doesn't make any kind of sense. So we have to give it a name and try and figure out what that is. So Krishna, it's a good name, because it means all attractive. So that means all the qualities of everything is in him. So that's pretty attractive, you know. If we see things that are attractive, yeah, we're attracted to it. And if all the qualities are there, then that is ultimately the most attractive, of course. So if we try to connect it back like that, everything gets straightened out. But unfortunately, we're very forgetful. And we have these anarthas, we have these tendencies, because we get used to everything and it feels secure. Problem is, the material world is always changing, so it generates anxiety, right? If you take shelter, this is the problem. Consciousness is eternal. It doesn't get tired. If you ask an old person, he feels like he's young. It's just the body doesn't feel as young, right? So the consciousness is eternal, but the body is temporary. So the eternal consciousness has taken shelter of something temporary. That generates anxiety. It's like borrowing money in a bank, you know, you have interest and you have to pay it back. But it generates some kind of anxiety. If you live in a straw hut on no foundation, you better not be too attached to it, because it's pretty obvious that it's not going to last very long. So if you're attached to this material energy, it will generate anxiety. As soon as it's said that, you know, the benefit of attaining something material is 1/11th of a second. That's the blink of an eye, you know. That's how long it takes. And then it just becomes part of your scene, you know, your thing. And then you have to maintain it. And that's hard work. So, you know, it just generates stress. And we can see that, you know, the more materialistic you are, the more stressed you are. There's one lady explaining to me the stress of leaving the house, because she was quite attractive and she felt like if she wasn't, you know, wearing the full makeup thing and everything was just right, she looked hideous to herself. She looked hideous, you know, and you have like 99% of the female population who would give their right arm to look like her. Of course she had both arms, but anyway. So it just generates anxiety. The taste is temporary. Just recently I spoke with one, also a lady I know, and she was beaming, she was very happy and she was smiling, and I was like, you see sometimes these, you say that ladies, they glow when they're pregnant, so I was thinking, wow, you know. So she said, freedom from children. So it was the first day of school, and it had been summer, and the children had been home, and now they're going off to school, and she had the house all to herself. So we know that the material relationship of a mother and a child is the strongest, the most powerful in the material world. And here she is, you know, relishing the fact that they're just out of here, you know, they're gone, you know. So everything material, I mean, by that example, we could say that anything less powerful, it will also be a nuisance at some point, you know. You see these young people, they wish they were rich and famous, and then you see the famous people, they're wearing sunglasses and everything, you know, and running into the limousine because it's just a nuisance, all these cameras and all this, nobody will leave them alone. And so it doesn't work. So we have to get above that, we have to move beyond that. And that's why things are tools. They don't have value in itself. Only value is its connection to Krishna. So that's why also the idea of the materialist becomes that if I go against my nature, that means I'm free, right? We got guys acting like women and women acting like guys, and that's celebrated in the Western Hemisphere because it means that we can do whatever we want. But the fact remains that these persons are not actually happy, you know, because they're going against their nature. So if we look at it in a different way, in the spiritual perspective, that it's just a tool, you know, this, what I'm traveling around, is just a tool. Then it's like saying, you know, I'm not the body, so I can do whatever I want. Okay, I'm not my car, so I'll use it as a boat. You know, it's not going to work. If I drive down to the docks, I drive off the pier and into the water, and I drive off into the sunset, and I'll bring some Mahaprasad. Well, be great, bring some friends. It won't work because the car is still a car. I'm not the car, but the car is the car. So I'm not the body, but this body is the body. So that's how it works. It has a certain way of working. And other things, it's not working so well. So in this sense, like I'm pretty good at, you know, I read recently, public speaking is the number one fear. It's worse than death. So I'm not so affected by that. But then management and economy, I'm just horrible with it. You definitely don't want me doing that. So So what? Should I then, oh no, I want to do economy because I'm a devotee, I'm not my body, I can do anything I want. No, that's stupid. You just do whatever you feel inclined to. We say fan the spark. Where is the talent? Where is the taste? You do that, and then you go back to Godhead. Simple. It's very, very simple. That's the thing. It's so simple we miss it because we want all these funky arrangements because we think that will generate. And it generates some taste, but it's false. It's illusory, as we know from here, that we have an idea that I will be happy if I get money, or I will be happy if I get social position, I will be happy if I get a beautiful wife. And so then when we obtain that, then we say to ourselves, yes, now I'm happy. And then, because we're not very intelligent, let's face it, it takes a little while before we realize that, wait a minute, I have to maintain this now. And people are not that impressed as I thought they would be. And some even think that, who's this guy, you know, think he is. So then we have to come up with a new illusion. Okay, I'll get more money, or I'll get divorced and get another wife, you know. And, you know, you see these super rich people, they're on their fourth marriage because they think, I got the house, I got the job, you know, I got the facility, so she must be happy. And he's never home because the most reciprocation he's giving her is by looking at the picture on his office desk of his family. You know, that's why I'm doing it. He's never actually home with her. So he comes home one day and she's, I'm not going to go there, but it breaks down. It doesn't work. So looking at it in a more simple way, that, wait a minute, I'm not as big. So he said that it's a tightrope. The bhakti is a tightrope. You swing a little to the karmi side or a little to the jnani side, you're going to have trouble. You're going to fall down. Now, sadhana and association of devotees can be like the net that's below. But the rope it's tight and it's narrow. But if you make sure that you make yourself small, then it becomes very wide. You know, if you become a very big person, I'm very qualified, I'm giving class, I've got two garlands on, not one, check it out. You know, then it becomes very difficult because it's very, you know, it's very distracting. But if you just make yourself small and you just try to do your sadhana and think of the other devotees as being the object of worship, because Krishna descends through his devotees, he acts through his devotees. If they become your deities, then it works out actually very nicely because it's simple. It's so simple. So that means we have to train the mind, because the mind is very attracted to all this complexity. We see the material sphere, usually you'd have, like, if someone says something that nobody understands, that means he's very intelligent. So here we kind of try and reverse that. If you take something that's very complex and make it into something that's very simple that everybody understands, then you're intelligent, because that means you're able to draw out the essence of it. That's why the secondary creation we're talking about here is good, because if we are in material consciousness, we can connect everything, and we can see that everything is an aspect of Krishna. It's just him. It's not that he's left us alone, it's just that we're not able in our present state to deal properly, so we get like a little bit of a cheaper product to play around with. That's the external energy, because the external energy is not conscious, so we don't hurt it if we deal improperly. So in that way, so until we know how to deal properly, we gotta kind of hang out here. But it's still him, you know, he's still expanding it, and he's still sending his messengers, some more empowered than others. You know, we're all empowered by Krishna to preach, because we have been preached to. If we see most devotees in our movement, they're being cultivated by neophytes, not actually the sannyasis or the temple presidents directly. Indirectly, yes, but directly it's the neophyte, because the chit potency is flowing. That we're not doing anything. The chit potency is acting through us because we, to a certain extent, have developed the right mood. That's the Bhagavatam. The point of the Bhagavatam, develop that mood, and the chit potency will flow through you automatically. And that's why devotees who are advanced, we call advanced devotees, very often they look very young, because it's not so difficult. They're not struggling so much with life. So in the process of 40 years, they've spent the energy of someone in material consciousness would do in maybe 10 years. So we see that these very great personalities like Srila Prabhupada and Bhaktivinoda Thakur, they would get by with a couple of hours of sleep, you know, and then back to work. Why is that? Because they're not actually using energy, because they're not doing anything. Krishna is doing it. Prabhupada loved to read his own Krishna book. Why? Because he didn't write it. He was just transcribing. Krishna was writing it. So in that way it works out very nicely. But the point is, we have to become detached before we can attach ourselves to that. So I'm in a circus mood today, you know, that we had the tightrope and now we have the trapeze. We have to let go of one trapeze before we can kind of hang on to another one. So we have to let go of our material hankerings before we can grab on to Krishna. But it still functions simultaneously. So it's not that we have to become like sitting in the Himalayas and going Om for 8 years or something like that, because that won't work anyway, because we are active. We need to interact with something or someone. So it's a process of transferring our attachments and transforming them. And that's why this knowledge is good, because we can transform it into something that's conducive rather than destructive. So this is the process of that's why we're hearing about all this, and this is why it is a test, is because it is very challenging for us to accept. We have devotees who have left, and we have potential devotees who have not joined, because some of these things that are in here are just too far out to accept. But we need to get to that acceptance before we can actually make serious progress. I hear very often that science even confirms what's in Bhagavatam. You know, someone says that as a thing, you know, science confirms, but it doesn't. It's like if you take mathematicians and they're working on some kind of algorithm, and then you have a horse doing math and it stomps the right answer. Yeah, the horse confirms. No, it doesn't. And we have to realize that the Bhagavatam reality compared to the materialists is the same thing. So if the materialists are confirming what's in Bhagavatam, they don't confirm anything. The problem is, if we start to think like that, then as soon as we encounter a point where the scientists don't confirm, then what? Is it then less true, or is there a slight possibility it can't be true, or what? Is there a different value to the truth that's in Bhagavatam depending on whether or not the materialists confirm it or not? No, it's exactly the same. Because they're in illusion, they're faulty senses, they're in illusion, they have a cheating propensity. And what's the last one? Make mistakes. Yeah, I just made one. So it won't work. You will not get absolute knowledge from materialistic endeavors. It just doesn't work. We have to consult authority. And the Bhagavatam is the ultimate authority, because it has worked for thousands of years. We have literally billions of case studies, and they have all turned out positive. You know, even those who left, there was in the 80s, one lady, she sued ISKCON because she was unable to enjoy the material energy anymore. So even those who didn't take to the process, they know that it works. So if you take a PhD or a master's or something, they have some case studies, they have some evidence, and from that they make a conclusion. We have like evidence coming out of everywhere, you know, and it's all pointing in the same direction. If you take in the material sphere, you have the, we used to think but now we know. I've always enjoyed that, because it's every generation of scientists. We used to think but now we know. They don't say we used to think and now we think. No, we know now. And then the next generation comes, oh, we used to think but now we know. And now they're publishing books. So the idea is that they just think there's an unlimited amount of facts in every situation. You take some that you think are important and string them together into a theory, and that becomes your view of reality. Then someone else takes some other facts, string that together into a different theory, and now we used to think, but now we know. It's all bogus. The only thing that works is the Bhagavatam. And the only reason we're dealing with these things is because we have to connect it so that we are able to see Krishna everywhere. And that way, we will be on the fast track back to Godhead. So I'll take question or, yeah, Hare Krishna. Do we have a microphone?
Hare Bol.
Hare Bol.
Thank you very much for your lecture. You were speaking up about the subject and the object and the tool. And I have a little doubt about that, because One time I was asking one devotee, can I help you? I really wanted to reciprocate with her, like a senior. And then she said, no, thank you, I can take care of myself. So then there is like no reciprocation in that.
Yeah.
But you were saying that we have to have that consciousness that Krishna is the subject, the other devotees are the object,
yeah,
and we are the tool. But then there was no reciprocation there. Mm. And because, I don't know if I have been doing wrong all these years, but if anyone asks me, can I help you? I always say yes, because then there is a loving exchange,
yeah,
and a relationship.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
It's a good point. It's a good point. Yeah, everything is about relationship. Everything we do is about relationship to Krishna, and through that relationship to others. You know? So our relationship to Krishna goes through the devotees, but our relationship to the devotees also goes through Krishna. What you're experiencing is you did help. You know, you asked. She said nah, and then okay. You know, so then you go somewhere else and ask someone else. The etiquette of Vaishnava is always reciprocate. I mean, you see also like the sannyasi, you bow down to them. It's his duty to reciprocate, you know, in some way and give you a little attention and stuff like that. Because that's how it works. Also, the deities reciprocate. So that means that actually when the curtain is closed, there's no point in really paying obeisances to the deities because they're doing something else. They're being dressed or eating or something. So you find the right time and then you present yourself, can I help, can I serve? And then whatever comes, I mean, technically you could say that she says no and then you're serving her by finding somewhere else to go, you know. So it's not a big deal, you know, unless she was obnoxious, which, you know, but it's just you go somewhere else and then there will be some reciprocation there. If we develop that service attitude, then there will always be reciprocation. Maybe not there, but somewhere else there will be. So yeah, it's fine. Don't worry about it. Yeah. Gita Nagari Prabhu.
I think in the verse itself it said that in the subterranean heavenly planets there's three types of beings living there, Nagas, Daityas, and Danavas, is that what it said?
Daityas, Danavas, and Nagas.
Yeah, okay, what's the difference between a Daitya, a Danava, and a Naga?
I'm not sure. Anyone? Can we get the microphone down?
I know the Nagas are snake people, so it's the difference between a Daitya and a Danava. That's the one that kind of stumps me.
They all live as householders, it said here. Jananimas, you know? Have you done?
They're in the line of the Daityas.
Oh, okay. So the Daityas are the light of the Devis?
Demons.
Oh, yeah. So Prahlad Maharaj and such, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Oh. Did anyone get that? I can't hear here because you got all the fans going on. Yeah, the mic is out, so. Yeah, it's. Okay. We're working.
The devas, they're pious devotees. They get to Swagaloka. the inhabitants of the Bilbaswad, they're pious atheists? Oh, how does it work? Because they're both places of enjoyment. You know?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Geeta Nagari is again asking.
As far as I understand, that the people who go to Swargaloka, they're godly people who do godly austerities. And the people who, the souls who end up in Bilbaswarga, they're atheistic people who do atheistic austerities, like fasting that's not, how do you say, sanctioned by the Vedas. The demon who cut his flesh and threw it in the fire. So they do austerities, they do tapa, but it's not tapa that's sanctioned, godly tapa that's sanctioned in the Vedas. It's their own tapa that they make up, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole creation is tainted by ignorance, and as the further you go down, the more prominent the ignorance becomes. So it's just a matter of what quality of connection to Krishna, because it's all Krishna, you know, no matter how materialistic you are, it's still Krishna you're connecting with. A smoker, he still deals with fire properly, otherwise he wouldn't get the fire going. So it's just a matter of what quality of connection you have with Krishna. So, that's, yeah. Anyone else? Hare Krishna. Antaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki. Yeah.